Good evening. Welcome to The Blues. I'm Lee Hay, and tonight we'll be in conversation with Gary Golio, an author who writes books for children about famous musicians like Carlos Santana, Bob Dylan, and Jimi Hendrix, which was a New York Times bestseller. Tonight we'll hear about two of his other books, the first about Blind Willie Johnson, Dark Was the Night, Blind Willie Johnson's Journey to the Stars, and the other about Billie Holiday, Strange Fruit, Billie Holiday and the Power of a Protest Song. There'll be songs from both, along with Nina Simone's version of Strange Fruit, a song by Sonny Rollins, plus an interview with John Coltrane by Carl Eric Lindgren during one of Train's tours with Miles Davis. Here's Gary Golio on The Blues. Tell us about some of the musicians that you featured in your children's books and how you came about to start writing these children's books about musicians.
Well, I guess the two most important elements in the story are my beloved grandmother when I was quite young. We lived upstairs, she lived downstairs, so I spent a lot of time with her. And she'd had six daughters, so she never had any sons. And, you know, I was the first grandchild. It was really great. And we spent a lot of time together because she had, in the 40s, gone down to the actual studios. We lived outside of New York City. She would go in to actually, when you could do that, go into studios and listen to Frank Sinatra and Rudy Valley and all these amazing people, and she actually got to know some of them. So she was very into music, and we used to spend a lot of time watching TV programs where you'd see Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald, Pearl Bailey, all these wonderful musicians. And I never forgot that. She had a very broad sense of humanity and music, and always encouraged education and literacy with me. And so many years later, I became very interested in blues guitar, electric guitar, and I was playing myself. And I started reading the tome, Cesar Galbic, and I forget the other guy's name, about Jimi Hendrix. It was the first major biography. And the first 30 pages just caught my imagination because they're all about Jimmy growing up as a boy in Seattle, of all places. My wife was a children's book, and still is, a children's book author, and I started thinking along those lines, and I started writing a story about, because I thought the roots of, you know, there's so many myths about people like Jimmy and other musicians like Billie Holiday and Coltrane, it doesn't matter who it is, and I thought, boy, the roots of everything Jimi Hendrix was, it's all there growing up in Seattle. That's what started it all off, and the first book on Hendrix, it ended up on the New York Times bestseller list for a period of time, and I've just kept going.
Your latest book is about Blind Willie Johnson. Could you tell us about him?
Yes, Blind Willie Johnson was a very unusual musician. From the time he was about 7 or 8 years old, and he was born in Southeast Texas, not that far from Houston, but, you know, around Marlin, Independence, those places there, and very rural at the time in 1897, and he had a beautiful voice as a child. He decided he wanted to be a preacher when he was 5 years old. His father built him a cigar box guitar, which was very common back then, and long story short, his mother dies, and he goes blind through an accident when he's about 7 or 8 years old. And, you know, back in those days when you were blind, you know, what could you do to support yourself? So as he becomes a teenager, he starts singing in churches. He had a gorgeous voice and singing on street corners with his guitar accompanying himself. And he had a very unusual voice. It could be very rough and gravelly and just arresting. And on the other hand, what he was saying was this beautiful, tender stuff about, you know, it was all gospel. He was really, and became a lay preacher later on, and he made about 30 songs that were recorded with Columbia in 1927 to 1930, and they outsold Bessie Smith at the time. Unfortunately, as often happened with black performers then, it was on a non-royalty basis. So he got, you know, maybe $35 for a song, and then, which was a lot of money then, and then he never saw any money from the recordings. So after the Depression, that kind of faded out. he became a preacher. He kept singing. He died as a result of the fire in his house, which was a kind of a church and house. He died of pneumonia after the fire, and he was forgotten until the early 60s and the folk revival, and Reverend Gary Davis kept telling his students, hey, if you think I'm good, you got to hear this guy. And he would buy old 78s, boy, I wish I could get one now, and give it to his students like Stephen Grossman and say, Blind Willie Johnson, there's no slide guitarist like this man.
As God, I don't never change. He's God, always will be God. God in the middle of the ocean, God in the middle of the sea, by the help of the great creator, truly been a God to me. He's God, God don't never change. God always will be God. God in the creation, God when Adam fell, God way up in heaven, God way down in hell. He's God. God don't never change. God always will be God. Spoke to the mountain, said how great I am. Want you to get up this morning, skip around like a lamb. Well, he's God. God don't never change. God always will be God. God in the time of sickness, God in the doctor too, and the time of the influenza, he truly was the God to you. Well, he's God. God don't never change. He's God. Always will be God. God in the pulpit, God way down at the door, he's God in the amen corner. God don't over the floor. Well, he's God. God don't never change. God always will be God.
Around 1977, when Carl Sagan was sending up the first Voyager 1 space probe, they decided to put out this amazing thing, which was like the ancestor of the CD-ROM. And it was a big disc about the size of an LP. It was copper, coated in gold. It's called the Golden Record. And it had the sights and sounds of Earth and all these amazing things. And so Carl, fortunately, asked music historian Alan Lomax, like, Alan, what do you think? And he said, well, it's great. You got Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven, but you need stuff like Aboriginal singing, and you need to have this song on, which is the embodiment of human loneliness, to send out into the depths of space if any, you know, other civilization should ever discover this amazing record. And that song was Dark Was the Night, which is the title of this book for kids that I did.
Let's take a listen to it. Thank you. So that was Dark Was the Night, which is the song that is the focus of Gary Golio's book, Dark Was the Night, Blind Willie Johnson's Journey to the Stars, illustrated by E.B. Lewis. Tell us about E.B. Lewis and these illustrations.
E.B. Lewis is kind of a national treasure. I mean, he's not very old. He's probably about 60 years old, but he's done, I don't know, 75 books or something, and he's won just about every award, certainly in the children's book world and in illustration. His work is really masterful. It's realistic, and yet the color and the feeling, the human feeling that he somehow magically or miraculously puts into people's faces and their bodies, but now with this beautiful color, vibrant color, which he uses now, is really stunning. And he plays in the book, as I do in the text, with the idea of Willie's blindness, light and dark and outer space versus the earth. So it's darkness versus, you know, the light of earth. And also light, because Willie was very spiritual in his way, you know, the idea of light as wisdom and knowledge and discovering the universe and all that. And E.B. Earl Lewis did these amazing illustrations which show Willie growing up, because we only have one known photograph of the man, but he interpolated what Willie would have looked like at all these different ages with his slide guitar, with his penknife slide on the guitar. And I think it's a, you know, I've had great, great responses to the artwork. It's really, visually, I think it's really a stunning book.
It is, and there's a passage in the back of the book titled The Golden Record. I was wondering if you could share that with our listeners.
Sure. All right, so this is in the what we call the back matter, that area in the back of the book where you get a little more information beyond just the story that I wrote. The Golden Record. In 1977, NASA made a time capsule of sorts called the Golden Record to send out into space aboard Voyager 1. It was meant to portray the diversity of life on Earth and to promote peace. When scientist and astronomer Carl Sagan was choosing the sounds for the record, he asked renowned music historian Alan Lomax to help him. Lomax added songs and music from cultures all over the world, including Navajo Indian chants, jazz, Louis Armstrong, and rock and roll, Chuck Berry. His goal was to give the biggest picture of human-made sounds and the feelings they expressed. For that reason, Willie Johnson's wordless song, Dark Was the Night, was included right next to a string quartet by Beethoven. I think that's wonderful. Anyway, Lomax believed that Johnson powerfully conveyed the sense of loneliness that all people feel, something very important to know about human beings and life on planet Earth. And who is the Golden Record meant for? The U.S. president at the time, Jimmy Carter, said this in his introduction. We cast this message into the cosmos of the 200 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Some, perhaps many, may have inhabited planets and space-faring civilizations. If one such civilization intercepts Voyager and can understand these recorded contents, here is our message. This is a present from a small, distant world. a token of our sounds, our science, our images, our music, our thoughts, and our feelings. This record represents our hope and our determination and our goodwill in a vast and awesome universe. And on August 25th, 2012, Voyager 1, traveling through space at 38,000 miles per hour, became the first human-made object to leave our solar system and journey so far from Earth. On it is the song of a blind man, someone who knew both light and darkness, bearing a message of hope to the stars themselves.
And let's listen to a couple of more songs by Blind Willie Johnson.
Well, won't somebody tell me? Answer if you can. Won't somebody tell me? Tell what is the soul of a man? I'm going to ask the question. Please answer if you can. Is there anybody children can tell me? Tell what is the soul of a man? Well, won't somebody tell me? Answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me. Tell what is the soul of a man? I traveled different countries. I've traveled in forest land. I've found nobody could tell me. Tell what about the soul of a man? When won't somebody tell me? Answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me. Tell what is the soul of a man? I saw a crowd stand talking. I just came up in time. Was teaching the lawyer, the doctor. Well, a man ain't nothing but his mind. Well, I want somebody to tell me. Answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me. Tell what is the soul of a man. God, I want somebody to tell me. Answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me. Tell what is the soul of a man. I read the Bible often. I try to read it right. And for as I could understand, nothing but a burning light. God, I want somebody to tell me. Answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me. Tell what is the soul of a man. When Christ had entered the temple, the people all stood amazed. Was teaching the lawyers, doctors, how to raise a man from the grave. Well, I want somebody to tell me. Answer if you can. Want somebody to tell me. Tell what is the soul of a man. Well, I want somebody to tell me. Answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me. Tell what is the soul of a man. And nobody's fault but mine. Nobody's fault but mine. But I don't need my soul be lie. I have a Bible in my home. I have a Bible in my home. But I don't need my soul be lie. Why they tell me how to read? Why they tell me how to read? I don't need my soul be lost. Nobody fault but mine. Oh, Lord. Nobody fault but mine. I don't need my soul be lost. I've a Bible of my own, found in my trouble. Oh, Mother, she taught me how to read. Father, she taught me how to read. Father, in my trouble, nobody's fault but mine. Nobody's fault but mine. Father, in my trouble. And so that she taught me how to read. So that she taught me how to read. But I read my tabula. Nobody taught but mine.
So that was Blind Willie Johnson. Now let's turn to another one of your books called Strange Fruit, Billie Holiday and the Power of a Protest Song, which is illustrated by Charlotte Riley Webb. Tell us about Billie Holiday. Perhaps you could read a passage in the back of your book.
Sure. This is in the what's called the back matter of the book again, and it goes on, you know, beyond the text into what actually happened with Billie and her career. So Billie Holiday lived a rich and remarkable life, darkened by difficulties but also made bright by her many great successes as a musical artist. As a black woman, her accomplishments were all the more extraordinary given the times in which she lived. Billie was born Eleonora Fagan in 1915. Her father, a jazz guitarist, was not part of her early life. She met him many years later. And her mother left her in the care of different relatives as she traveled to find work. As a girl, Billie was often in trouble with the law and was even sent to prison for several months at the age of 14. Fortunately, by then she had already heard the music of Louis Armstrong, jazz, and Bessie Smith, blues, experiences that changed her life and inspired her to sing. By 1929, Billie was living with her mother in New York City, a vibrant world of music and the newest jazz. In small clubs and cafes, she began to work the floor, singing at customers' tables for tips and playing with her voice to make each song sound slightly different time after time. This was what made jazz unique and exciting, the spirit of improvisation that Billie learned from listening to trumpet and saxophone players change their solos to keep a song interesting and alive. When Billie was 17, respected music producer John Hammond, who incidentally later discovered Bob Dylan, heard her sing in Harlem and recognized her talents. He called her a jazz genius and helped her begin a recording career. Even in her early records, like I Cried For You, Billie used her voice to connect the melody of a song with the feeling behind the words.
I cried for you.
emotions she conveyed soon led to hit songs and work with band leaders like Count Basie and Teddy Wilson. She also became friends with jazz greats Lester Young on sax and Ella Fitzgerald, who of course was a singer. And in 1938, at only 22, Billy was hired by Artie Shaw, a big band leader, as one of the first black women to sing with an all-white band. There, her exposure to segregation and prejudice, particularly in the southern United States, made her keenly aware of racial injustice. When she came to Cafe Society, this is the club where Strange Fruit was first debuted in early 1939, when she came to Cafe Society and sang Strange Fruit in early 1939, Billy began to understand the power of song to provoke outrage, encourage change, and inspire healing. And I'll just add that, you know, she was spat upon, humiliated, criticized, insulted for singing this song, which is a song about the horrors of lynching, even though it's an extremely beautiful melody and song, and Billy sings it, you know, as she sings everything really beautifully. But she did that because, you know, one of the points I'm trying to make in this book is that Billy was a social activist. You know, most people don't think of her as that. She was a great musical artist, but she also knew exactly what she was doing. And in the 1940s, she achieved great popular success and came to be regarded as a supreme vocalist, someone whose musical style was imitated and admired by other younger singers. She won many top jazz polls, acted in movies, and wrote some of her own songs. Sadly, as her fame increased, so did her use of alcohol and drugs. After a short period of time in prison, she returned to great popular and critical acclaim, but her health had already begun to suffer. By the time Billy died in 1959 at the age of 44, she was considered one of the greatest female vocalists and jazz singers of her time. While the difficulties of her life played a part in her death, those painful experiences also made it possible for Billy to perform with a depth of feeling that makes her work unforgettable. Many people have tried to sing Strange Fruit with as much power and tenderness, but few have come close. And I would say people who have come close would certainly include Nina Simone.
7 feet barren, strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the roots. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South. Them big bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia, clean and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck. The rain together, for the wind to suck, for the song to rot, for the leaves. here is strange, and bitter
And I'm wondering now if we could play Strange Fruit, and after that, if you could continue by sharing another page entitled What Happened Next afterwards.
Sure, whatever you want.
Strange Fruit, sung by Billie Holiday. And we're speaking with Gary Golio about his book, Strange Fruit, Billie Holiday and the Power of a Protest Song. Would you like to go ahead and continue sharing what happened next?
So in the back of the book is another section that helps librarians, teachers, kids, families, you know, to understand what happened after Billie sang Strange Fruit in early 1939. News traveled fast after Billie debuted Strange Fruit in March of 1939. Even before an article in Time magazine hit the stands, crowds filled the tables at Cafe Society, and this was in Greenwich Village, to hear her sing that song. The publicity made Billie a star and gave her the confidence to go one step further. When her producer and record company refused to record Strange Fruit, she turned to an independent jazz label. Released as a single with another song on the flip side, Strange Fruit eventually sold 1 million copies. It became Billie's best-selling record as well as her signature song. even as most radio stations in America refused to play it. From then on, Billie was often verbally or physically harassed for singing Strange Fruit. She nevertheless insisted that it be written into her contract when performing at clubs and concert halls throughout the United States. Billie referred to Strange Fruit as her personal protest and sang it as a gift to her people to voice their suffering. Close friends said that singing the song made her both sick and upset, after all she'd seen and experienced as a black woman. Lynching is the execution, most often by hanging, but also by burning or shooting, of a man, woman, or teen by a lawless crowd or mob without due process. Lynching, as a term, has uncertain origins, but is usually attributed to Charles Lynch, 1736 to 1796, a Virginia planter and justice of the peace who held informal trials of British loyalists during the American Revolutionary War. Between 1882 and 1939, there were nearly 5,000 lynchings in the United States, with almost 75% of these involving black Americans. By the time Abel Meeropol, he's the songwriter who wrote the poem and then the song Strange Fruit, by the time he wrote Strange Fruit and Billie sang it, the numbers had dropped considerably, though racism and oppression, both legal and social, remained widespread. Attempts to pass a federal anti-lynching bill in Congress that had begun, you know, after the Civil War, would not succeed until 2005. Strange Fruit brought attention to the deep-rooted problem of racism and spoke to millions of black and white Americans yearning for a more just and civil society. It proved to be a powerful example of protest art and galvanized what would become the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. Perhaps most important, the story of Strange Fruit demonstrates what can be accomplished when like-minded people, and in the story, those like-minded people are Abel Meeropol, the songwriter, and Barney Josephson, the owner of Cafe Society, the club, focus their talents and energies on a common goal and harness the power of art to create something far greater than themselves.
This song in your book is very relevant in this time of the Black Lives Matter movement. Can you speak to that?
Well, I started writing this book around 2012, and I was inspired by an adult book for an adult audience by David Margolick, the music critic and historian. And it was about Cafe Society and this amazing club in New York City that was run by a man named Barney Josephson. And Barney and Abel Meeropol, who actually, interestingly, he and his wife, Abel and his wife Anne, adopted the two Rosenberg children, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, after their parents were electrocuted. In the town in which I live, Ossining, New York, which is where Sing Sing prison is, in 1953. So Abel and Barney were members of a group in the 1930s called Negro Liberation, which meant, at that time, it was white people, allies, you know, who believed in fair treatment, trying to help American blacks, or called Negroes at the time, to achieve a measure of equality in society, economically and artistically. So Barney Josephson, this other fellow, he had gone to the Cotton Club in Harlem, and he loved black performers and black art and black music. But when he went there, he realized that the people in Harlem who lived around the club were not permitted to come there because it was an all-white audience, even though there were many, many, you know, legendary black performers. So he decided to open a club in Greenwich Village called Cafe Society. And the front row seats were always reserved for black patrons. Anyone could come, white or black or Asian or anyone, but the front row seats were reserved for black patrons specifically. And he did that because it was an attempt to redress inequalities. And when people talk about Black Lives Matter, sometimes they say, well, but all lives matter and white lives matter too. But the truth, the problem is that you don't have to say that white lives matter because they always did. And the reason that Barney wanted, when he heard Abel Meeropol play this song for him, he said, the reason I want Billie Holiday to sing this song is because it's very powerful. It has a great message and she's a great artist. And he paired her with that song, and at the end of her set every night, everyone would stop, all the employees, everybody in the club would stop what they were doing. A pin spot would be on Billie's face, this would be the last song that she would sing, and he said to her, Barney said to her, when you're done, I don't care how many people are applauding or not, you just exit the stage, and that will be the dramatic end to your set with this song. And the first time they did this, in March of 1939, she sang, she exited, and the room was completely silent. People were stunned by what they'd heard. They were trying to make sense of this beautiful song and the message, the kind of sad and tragic message that it contained. And then one person started clapping, and the room kind of erupted into applause. And every night after that, the place was packed, and she became, you know, a star. So, I wrote it because many people were dying. People had cell phones then. We were seeing these videos. Many black women and men, mostly young people, were being shot on the streets of our country. And it was very upsetting to me as someone who really, really appreciates blues, jazz, black culture, and music, and black human beings. A lot of my illustrators have been black artists, and I'm close with them. So I thought this book would be a way, and it's very age-appropriate. It doesn't show anything disturbing. The artwork by Charlotte Riley Webb, who was a black woman, I thought that was very appropriate. She is a remarkable artist and illustrator, and only at the end do you see the lyrics of the song. So there's nothing, you know, it's very appropriate for kids. It's meant to introduce them to the power of art. It's just that in this case, it's the power of a protest song. Now, Strange Fruit became, many years later, in the 1950s and 60s, people would say that in the civil rights movement, that this song was really the cornerstone of the civil rights movement later on. So I think Billy did a marvelous thing, and all you have to do is listen to that song to get the chills in a good way.
Well, I love your books. They're appropriate not only for children, but also for adults, which is something that parents can share with their children and give them insights, not only into music, but into various cultures and cultural events. So thank you for what you're doing.
Well, thank you, Leif.
So do you have any more books on the drawing board?
Yes, I have a book coming out next year with the really wonderful artist James Ransom. It's a picture book about Sonny Rollins and the kind of sabbatical that he took in late 1959 when he was at the top of the jazz world and decided to walk away because, as he told me in a number of wonderful telephone interviews that we've had, conversations, he said, I just didn't think I was as good as they thought I was, and I felt like a bit of a fraud. So he walked away, and he spent a year and a half just going up every day because he had no place to practice. He went up, he lived in the Lower East Side of New York City, and he would walk over to the Williamsburg Bridge that connects Manhattan to Brooklyn, and he would go up to the pedestrian walkway, which in those days was not some cool thing. It was pretty gritty. And this wasn't to put out his open, his case, and to make money. There was nobody there except the birds, the fog, the foghorns from the river below, the sound of the trains clanking along on the tracks. And it's really kind of a pre-verse kind of poem about how he was sending notes up into the sky and to the foghorns who were echoing him down below, and kind of having musical conversations with the clacking and the clanging of the subway cars and his own keys on the saxophone. And Sonny and I continue to talk to this day, and he's just turned 90 at the beginning of this month, and he's remarkably sharp, always has interesting things to say, but he doesn't want to talk about music at all. All he wants to talk about is his spirituality. And he's like an old yogi, you know, he fasts and he prays, and I think people would be very surprised. But if you listen to his music, that's what you're hearing inside the music. You're hearing the expression of a very human-oriented spiritual man. The book is probably one of the more fun books I've done, but it also tries to get that sense of him as somebody trying to listen to that small voice inside of ourselves that tells you what to do, that you need to do, when everybody else says, I don't think that's a good idea, but you know you have to do it, and that's really what it's all about.
Speaking of spirituality and jazz, tell us about your book about John Coltrane.
Ah, Coltrane. Well, the book is called Spirit Seeker for a reason, because from the time he was very young, and when he was the grandson of two ministers, the AME Methodist Zion Church, and he lived with one of his grandfathers, his mother's father, and he was a very quiet kid, very serious kid. All the men in his life, grandfather, father, uncle, they all died when he was 13. And just as destiny would have it, someone came along in the town, I think it was a lay minister, who had said, let's have a community band for kids. And John eventually got a saxophone, and the rest is history. He was a very sensitive child. He was often very depressed. He'd lost his father, his uncle, his grandfather, and began drinking at an early age and later using drugs, all the while still becoming a great musician. Finally, when he's in Miles Davis' group, Miles, who had also kicked heroin, said to him, you're out. You know, unless you get clean, don't come back here. And he did this. He stayed in his room in Philadelphia at his mother's house for a week with nothing but water, and he went cold turkey, essentially, and he attributed that to his faith. He had an unusual concept of God. It was traditional, but it was also, he was into Buddhism and yoga and expansive concepts of the Creator, and he attributed his success recovering from drug use and his success as a world-class musician to his faith.
Well, it's a pleasure and an honor to have John Coltrane in front of our microphone here. And John, I gotta be abrupt with you. I gotta say like this, that your playing has been termed antenna-like, unbeautiful, on just about everything you can think of. And since the playing mirrors the personality, I guess you have some personal thoughts of that kind to say.
Let me follow you again. You said my plan has on what?
I didn't say that. I said what the critics said.
Said, oh, well, they seem to think that it's an angry sort of a thing. It's real. Some of them do. I don't know about the critics here.
Do you feel angry?
No, I don't. I was talking to a fellow today, and I told him that the reason I play so many, it sounds, maybe it sounds angry because I'm trying so many things at one time, you see. Like, I haven't sorted them out. I have a whole bag of things that I'm trying to work through and get the one essential, you know.
Would you say that you're trying to play everything you hear one time or something like that?
No, there are some set things that I know, some devices that I know, harmonic devices that I know, that will take me out of the ordinary path, you see, if I use these. But I haven't played them enough, and I'm not familiar with them enough yet to take the one single line through them. So I play all of them, you know, trying to acclimate my ear so I can hear, you know.
In the album liners of your latest LP, that was the Giant Steps LP, which we have played quite a lot on this show, you claim that you were trying to get a more beautiful sound. With that?
Well, I hope to play not necessarily a more beautiful sound, though I would like to, just say tone-wise, I would like to be able to produce a more beautiful sound. But now I'm primarily interested in trying to work what I have, what I know, down into a more lyrical line. You know, that's what I mean by beautiful, by more lyrical, so to be, you know, easily understood.
I'm sure our listeners are, as they are mainly collectors of Coltrane records. I'm sure they like to hear you express one thought of what you think is listenable among your whole production.
You mean of the albums that I made? I like Blue Train myself.
I figured you would.
There's such a good band on there, you know.
That's a real dangerous album, man.
It was a good recording.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about this last quartet recording here, the Giant Step thing?
I think that was my best quartet recording so far, with the exception of maybe Soul Train. I'd put them both about the same.
How would you say working with Miles Davis has influenced you stylistically?
Well, it has led me into most of the things that I'm doing now, you know.
He has had a major stranglehold on you in that matter. I mean, he made you play the way you do, or you got a chance to play like
you
do.
Well, I've been free. I've been so free here, you know, that almost anything I want to try is... I'm welcome to do it, you know, so that's the freedom has helped me.
I heard you were
splitting
the Miles Quintet here and then trying something on your own.
Yes, I am.
How's that? With whom?
I have several men in mind, but I haven't selected the side men yet, you know. I'm going to try with the quartet.
What do you feel like working with, a quartet?
Yeah, to begin with, and maybe in several weeks after I start, I might add a fifth man.
John, which tenor players do you think have influenced you, if any at all?
All of them. I would say all of them. But,
do you have a personal favorite? I mean, like you put on a record when you were at home and relaxing and so on?
Well, Sonny Rollins is, I think he's outstanding tenor man today, you know.
That's exactly what Sonny Rollins told me on this show about you. So
that's usually, you know,
seems to
my
be
man.
A mutual admiration society.
Yeah,
here.
Well, he's great. I mean, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in the formative days, years ago, it was Dexter Gordon that actually was.
You do have a strong feeling for tradition, haven't you?
I guess so. I mean, I would like to even make it stronger. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to strengthen my roots, so to say, you know, because I didn't start at the beginning, and there's a whole lot back there that's, you know, that all young musicians
do
should
you,
have.
Privately, I mean, when you're listening, you go back there, I mean, just on your own account and listen?
Well, I don't have many records in that era now, but I do plan to get them. I plan to include that in my repertoire, you know, all these old traditional things.
You got an open mind, huh?
I've been trying recently to search myself, you know, and try to find things that are reminiscent that sound like those things. But I'm really going to do some work on that soon.
Well, John, it seems like you're on with the Miles Davis Quintet here, and thank you very much for taking the time and dropping in on this show.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
The great piece that he wrote, of course, it was his tribute to the Creator, above supreme. A Love Supreme, you know, where he like chants that like 18 times, right? A Love Supreme. Yes, A Love Supreme. And of course, A Love Supreme is the Godhead, you know, in his mind. You know, he once said a few years before he died, someone asked him what he hoped to do or be in the next 10 years. And he said, he didn't know that he wasn't going to live that long, but he said, I want to be a saint. And some people didn't really understand what he meant, but what he meant was, he didn't want to be famous. He didn't want to be canonized as a saint. He wanted to become a really good soul and a good person who believed, as Sonny Rollins does, because they were good friends, in the Golden Rule, and that your life is really defined by how you treat other people. That was Coltrane, and I feel like, you know, some is like spiritual stuff, the substance of his being is inside those songs, especially Love Supreme.
There are some musicians who seem to be channeling the music from somewhere.
He was definitely one of them. And, I mean, there are many people in different cultures who do that, that we even, you know, that we know. I mean, I think Nina Simone, once again, I think she really could do that. And there are certain songs that have that quality in them, that have kind of a spiritual underpinning. And one back to Blind Willie Johnson, I mean, if you listen to Dark Was the Night, which is wordless, and yet, you know, it just kind of leaves you speechless at the end because it's very deeply spiritual and human. His song, The Soul of a Man, is also about the enigma of the mystery of being a human being on planet Earth and what it means that we are born, we die. What we do in between is what matters.
So your books spoke to me, so I'm glad that we could share them with everyone. Thanks for your work. It's wonderful.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a conversation with children's book author Gary Golio about two of his books, about songs by musicians Blind Willie Johnson and Billie Holiday. You'll find links on my blues page at WVXU.org. Thanks for listening to 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford. I'm Lee Hay.